Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like to welcome to the program Caroline Fraser. She's the author of the book Rewilding the World, Dispatches from the Conservation Revolution, which just came out in paperback. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You start out the book with a description of a biologist who had a bunch of, he lived in a canyon. He had a lot of cats. The cats kept getting eaten by coyotes, and he didn't mind. And this is an illustration, I mean, I'm sure he'd mind it in some ways, but it's kind of an illustration of the way in which there are all sorts of interconnections in ecosystems which are not readily apparent.
That's right. He is an amazing guy, Michael Soule, who essentially with a colleague invented the whole concept of rewilding. But what happened with his cats was something that I think sparked a realization in him of the importance of predators, particularly top predators in the ecosystem. Because what he was looking at with the coyotes in the San Diego canyons was an example of a top predator that was taking out what he calls a mesopredator, a smaller predator, which was cats. His cats and other people's cats, pet cats generally in the landscape, do function as a smaller predator. And because he was a biologist, he started wondering what this meant, how this was affecting the ecosystem as a whole. And what he was able to find, he did a lot of studies of this with his students, because he was teaching at the time in San Diego, led to the realization that the coyotes were acting as a control on the smaller predators, like the cats. And that was really critical, because it actually tells us a lot about why we're losing so many songbirds in this country, because we have taken out all our top predators virtually everywhere in the continental United States. We've taken out the wolves, we've reduced the number of mountain lions, we don't have that many bears in most areas, except in parks. And so what those small predators are doing is targeting the things that they can catch, which is the songbirds. And you see groups like Audubon constantly telling people, you know, this is a really critical problem in this country. We're losing songbird populations all over the country. And this, it turns out, is why. Because we've got a big problem with those small predators.
So the more coyotes you have, the more birds you have.
That's right, which is something that I think nobody would have imagined. It's
right.
A really counterintuitive realization.
And that is an example of which there are many, many other examples. And it's not just about humans getting messed up with having domestic cats. In the wild, having those top predator carnivores, which are keystone species, and there's other keystone species which we'll talk about, keeps an ecosystem in check in virtually every landscape.
Right, and I think most people are aware of the fact that in this country we have a tremendous overpopulation of deer, and yet I think it's hard for people to make that leap to realizing, oh, the reason that we have too many deer is because we got rid of their chief predator, which is the wolf.
Now, another example of a non-predator that serves an incredibly important function, and this is an animal that is sort of dear to my heart and that we've talked about a lot, is prairie dogs. But it turns out that prairie dogs are absolutely crucial to both the water table and to the grasslands that they live on and under.
Yeah, species like prairie dog, and there are several species in the West, they used to play an enormously important role in these prairie ecosystems of keeping areas open, because they're basically running around and eating all the little things that might turn into trees or shrubs or larger plants. And so they're keeping a prairie ecosystem open. They're also, through their tunnels and their burrows, funneling water down to the water table in a direct way, which we can't really replicate. And now that we have eliminated prairie dogs from about 90% of their former habitat, we're starting to see some of the repercussions of that. We're seeing a degradation of the grazing territories. We're seeing problems with our water tables because we're drawing down too much water. So these are things we need to think about with every species, is thinking about what is their function in the ecosystem.
And understanding that is the work of conservation biologists, and it is key to the understanding of this term rewilding, which is in the title of your book. It's a concept that embraces a very big picture. It includes carnivores and keystones, as we were just talking about, and also cores and corridors. Mm-hmm. Lots of alliteration here. Talk about this whole three C's. How do they go together? How do they make for ecosystem preservation?
Well, when they came up with the scientific method, and again, this was Michael Soule was very instrumental in this, they were looking at what do we have to get back that we've lost. And one of the key realizations in the past 20, 30 years has been that our protected areas are just not big enough. As we've learned more about genetic health of populations, we've realized that what we did when we created national parks, while it was a brilliant idea, we didn't know enough about what individual populations needed in terms of their genetic health. So now we're discovering we need bigger protected areas. Those are the core areas. We need corridors to connect them because we've really isolated these small protected areas from each other so that populations can't reach each other.
And they need to migrate.
And they need to migrate.
And they need to interbreed.
They need to disperse and find other populations so that the population doesn't become inbred. And we need those top carnivores. So that's the three C's, is the cores, corridors, and carnivores.
The politics and history of this whole movement, which is relatively recent, is something that you talk about, so that you write about so beautifully in this book. I have to say to our listeners out there, this book, Rewilding the World, is so well written. You read it like a novel. You can't even put it down. And one of the analogies that I thought was so interesting is here was this well-meaning effort to identify and conserve. Well, if you can't do a big patch of land, at least a little patch of land. And somebody said, if you took a Persian carpet and cut it up into 36 pieces, how much would each piece be worth by itself? Right. And in this, the answer, of course, is nothing. And in the same way, little patches of land, if not connected, really don't do all that much for conservation.
Yeah, that's right. That's an analogy that David Quammen talks about in his book, The Song of the Dodo. And I think it's quite brilliant because it really captures the fraying quality of our protected areas and our national parks, that they're really kind of coming apart. And in fact, there has been research that has proven that every single national park in the West, with the single exception of the largest one, has been losing species since it was created.
Now that ties into a concept that was first understood when biologists looked at islands. Mm-hmm. And how the smaller the island, the smaller the number of species. And when an area, a preserved area, let's say, is surrounded by development, it functions as an island.
Right. And the problem with islands is that they tend to only allow a certain number of species to flourish over time. And the smaller the island, the fewer the species. And so that can be extrapolated to our park system. If you look at a map of the national parks in the West, you'll see how small they are and how isolated they are from each other. And basically what we have done is to create a lot of islands within the larger landscape of the country.
Now, when these islands are national parks, are conservation areas, are wildlands, are connected by corridors, as they're called, do they then stop functioning as islands? Do they survive and thrive better?
Yes, they've done a lot of research in the past 30 years to try to figure out how to design these corridors, because it will be different for different species, but that is the idea, that to allow species to reach each other, different populations of wolves, for instance, to reach each other, is going to strengthen the whole system. There's also a phenomenon that they call edge effects, which has a really strong impact on protected areas, which is that when you develop too close to a park, if you're developing right outside the boundaries of a park, that starts to actually kind of creep in and destroy the fabric of the whole system of life in that park. And so one thing that corridors can do is to allow species to move. It can also help reduce those edge effects.
What do corridors look like for different species, and how do you identify what is an effective corridor for, let's say, wolves or pronghorn antelope or other species that migrate?
Well, that's a central question, and that was something that particularly wolf biologists and biologists working on some of these big top predators have been looking at, how they move and what the size of their territories are. With the development of some of these more sophisticated forms of satellite tracking of species, it has become possible just recently to track wolves in real time and to see where they're going. Before, it was just too expensive, too difficult to follow an individual wolf wherever they were going throughout their life. But they can do that now, and they've seen that the territories of some of these animals are huge. I mean, they really take in an enormous amount of territory, going all the way from Canada down around Glacier, back up to Canada, you know, around Banff. So they're covering a lot of territory. And what that means is that we need to preserve those areas between national parks like Glacier and Banff as much as we can. And it doesn't, you know, people aren't really talking about making those parks bigger. We can't do that at this point. There's too much private property and too much development in the way. But what we can do is figure out ways that will allow species like wolves to travel without getting killed.
One of the ways that seems so simple and is used by a lot of animals, apparently, is highway crossings. First of all, the very fact that so many animals and people are killed and so much human damage and vehicle damage is done because of wildlife crossings and wildlife accidents makes that in itself an important thing to do. But here you can just basically put an overpass, an underpass?
Yeah, I mean, these highway crossing structures are really no more than what we constantly are putting in terms of allowing people to cross highways or allowing cars to enter and exit. You just put an overpass or an underpass on the highway or railway, and you just line it with a kind of natural substrate so that species will be comfortable using it.
So they're walking on dirt rather than asphalt.
Yeah, they're walking on dirt or some combination of dirt and gravel, and possibly, if it's an overpass, some shrubbery to provide some cover. And that's it. And they've put in some of these structures up near Banff along the Trans-Canada Highway. And these have been enormously successful in reducing collisions with wildlife. I think between 80 and 90% reduction in accidents caused by hitting large animals like elk or wolves or bears. So it's good for people and wildlife.
And insurance companies like it too.
that's right. Insurance companies are really behind these things now. And now we're seeing projects like this on the I-90 corridor in Washington State. We're seeing them in Colorado for bighorn sheep. They've used them in Florida to allow the very endangered Florida mountain lions to cross the Everglades Highway. So they're really being put into use in a lot of places in the U.S. They've been used in Europe for many years, but we're just kind of understanding how important they can be here.
We're talking to Caroline Fraser, author of the new book, Rewilding the World, Dispatches from the Conservation Revolution. The necessity for rewilding the world is absolutely critical. Biologists are, as you write, calling the moment that we're in the sixth great extinction. And there is talk about this being, in some ways, the end of evolution itself. with the possible exception of resistant strains of bacteria, things and viruses and things like that. But what's going on?
Well, they call it the sixth great extinction because the rate of extinction has grown so fast and so much in the past couple of decades that it really amounts to what they call a mass extinction event. There have been several of these events before in the history of the planet, but they all occurred before we came along. What they know about these prior events is that some of them were definitely associated with very sharp changes in the climate. So that's something we should think about as we proceed with our activities now. But the problem with extinction's a natural process, but it's usually a very rare event. It usually occurs only on the level of maybe a couple of species at a time over a period of many years. But what we're seeing now is a real expansion. We're seeing between 100 and 1,000 times the natural rate of extinction.
The reasons for this are what? Overpopulation, development, climate change, pollution, all of the above?
Yeah, predominantly it is habitat change. We're altering habitat at an incredible rate. We're cutting down forests. We're turning natural habitat into agricultural areas or grazing areas very, very rapidly. We're also making huge changes in our climate. We've really disrupted the stability of the climate in such a way that it's affecting plants and animals in virtually every part of the world.
And as you write, it's very important to know the effect that changing, for example, from forest land to grazing land or forest land to agricultural monocrop land, the effect that has on the weather, on cloud formation, on climate.
Yeah, we're just starting to understand how drastically it affects the climate to turn something from a forest, which is green and reflects sunlight in a certain way, to taking all that out and making the huge areas of the landscape respire differently, which has, putting in plants which have a very different rate of respiration, of releasing moisture into the atmosphere. When we do that on such a vast scale with these huge monoculture crops, we can, in fact, affect the climate across an entire continent. And this they have seen and measurably studied in Australia. They've seen very sharp changes in areas where they took out the natural vegetation, which had had evolved in a very complex way to reflect sunlight and to survive in the very low moisture levels that they have there in their very arid and salty climate. They took all that vegetation out and replaced it with wheat, which has a very different rate of releasing moisture into the atmosphere, releases it at different times of the year. And they essentially created a vast dust bowl effect in certain parts of Australia when they did this.
Just as the dust bowl conditions can be human created, you also have some examples of restoration projects. There was one, I think, in Borneo, where some real intense forest restoration was done almost from scorched earth, and it changed the rainfall patterns and cloud formation for the better.
Yeah, it's really stunning to see the ability with which we have to restore areas. If we plant back native vegetation, we can see real changes in the atmosphere, in the carbon levels, in the degree of rainfall in certain areas. I mean, and Indonesia has had some really major crises with wildfires breaking out there, massive events which can be seen from space that have actually measurably altered the carbon in the atmosphere during specific years. And they have done some amazing things there on a small scale. I mean, some of this is not to the scale that it really should be done. But if we could go in and really do significant amounts of forest restoration, we would see some real improvements in our climate.
And there's a funny thing that happens, and you write about this in the book too, which I found just fascinating, is that sometimes people who do that are actually going against the PR campaigns of the conservation organizations that in theory support that kind of stuff, because somebody has a conservation campaign that says once the rainforest is gone it can't be brought back, and then somebody's bringing it back.
Right. There is, I think, a lot of concern about the message of restoration, because conservation groups understandably don't want polluters and people who just want to grow, you know, palm oil on a vast scale. They don't want them to feel free to go in and cut down primary rainforest.
Because, hey, we can restore it later.
Right. I mean, that's exactly the wrong message. And it's understandable that they don't want people to take away a false sense of security that we can regrow forest. Because although forest will return, particularly in tropical areas, it comes back really fast. But the problem is it doesn't come back with the same biodiversity, the same very complex relationships between species and plant life that you had before. And so there are good reasons not to, you know, talk about this in a simplistic way, which I think is what those conservation groups are really worried about. But on the other hand, restoration is a really powerful tool.
I think it's important at moment like this, when that kind of debate is going on, to talk about why is a biodiverse forest so much better and more important and functional than a regrown forest that doesn't have that kind of biodiversity.
Yeah, biodiversity, I think, is a really tricky concept to talk about and to understand, because I think we're used to talking about nature. You know, you look out the window and you see green stuff and you think that's nature. and that's sort of a simpler idea that we grew up with. But in recent years, biologists have come to realize how really complex ecosystems are. And the complexity comes from the diversity of species within them. And that ranges from everything like those big top predators we were talking about, all the way down to microorganisms in the soil that most people are not even aware exist. And yet those microorganisms can be tremendously important in replacing the arable nature of the soil and in keeping alive this incredible diversity of organisms that exist in rainforests and tropical forests. And I just saw the other day an amazing statistic that half of our pharmaceutical market comes from organisms that come from the rainforest and
Wow.
from the oceans.
The rainforest and the oceans.
Yeah, the marine organisms are incredibly important in developing new drugs for treating cancer and so forth. Research is being done now on these exotic cone snails, which are found in tropical areas of the oceans, which have a certain neurotoxin in their bodies that has led to the development of a whole new class of painkillers for people who have cancer. So, you know, there's an enormous value to these organisms that most of us will never encounter in our regular lives. You know, most of us are not divers, or most of us are not exploring in the rainforest. We're not going to see these creatures, but they have an intense function in the ecosystem, and they also have an incredible dollar value.
Well, you know, we're not going to see our own microflora in our stomach either, but we can't live without those.
That's very true.
We're talking to Caroline Fraser, author of the book Rewilding the World, Dispatches from the Conservation Revolution. You write about some more and less successful examples of attempts at rewilding. Do you want to start with the Y2Y, Yellowstone to Yukon to Yellowstone?
Yellowstone to Yukon.
Yellowstone to Yukon.
Yeah, Y2Y is a really interesting grassroots initiative that was one of the first big rewilding efforts that was really looking at The whole landscape from Canada all the way down the whole Rocky Mountain corridor down to basically New Mexico. This was really the first time that I think a lot of activists and people involved in conservation had looked at the whole landscape and really examined what do we need to do to try to preserve connectivity, to try to create some buffer zones around national parks that will help them survive into the future. And that's where some of those ideas about highway crossing structures came into existence, you know, and became, you know, they were really pushing on those ideas as a way to try and restore connectivity that had been lost. They're also looking at development, trying to examine where are the most endangered points of connection in the landscape, and could those be wiped out by a development here or a golf course there or a road in the wrong place, and trying to work with developers and private property owners and landscape planners to try and forestall those things before they happen.
And in some cases, successfully doing so.
Yes, I think that they have had some success in that. The problem, of course, in this country is the politicization of environmental issues. And I think that that has been a kind of a drag on the project because in some areas there's an enormous resistance to the presence of wolves. There's resistance to just the very idea of environmentalists coming in and telling people what to do. You know, there's an idea that these are the kind of people who just want to take over your lives or take your private property, and I don't think those things are really true, that's the kind of climate that they're dealing with.
New Mexico has its own example for when we talk about the attempt to reintroduce the Mexican gray wolf into the southern New Mexico landscape. That didn't work out. I mean, it's still going on, but it hasn't worked out so well.
Yeah, it's a tragic example of what can go wrong when there's a lack of communication, a lack of education about what wolves really represent, and an enormous amount of fear of the species, which I think is almost a kind of primal fear that people have about top predators. And sometimes it's more justified than others. I don't think it's justified at all in the case of the Mexican wolf.
But at the same time, you have New Mexicans illegally shooting wolves.
Yeah, we've seen that since the beginning. There's been a really adamant resistance in Catron County and some of these areas, which I think is really just one more example of people working against their own best interests, because the wolf up north in Montana and Idaho and Wyoming has brought an enormous amount of revenue to those communities that have understood that this has ecotourism potential, that tourists come because they want to see these incredible wild animals. That could happen in Catron County too.
And even if Catron County didn't become an ecotourism center, there's still an argument to be made that the reintroduction of wolves has had a very minimal effect on livestock.
Yes, that is undoubtedly true. And I think it brings us to a discussion that we need to have about whether livestock grazing is in fact the best use of our public lands in certain areas of the country, particularly in the Southwest, which is very arid, doesn't have enough water, and where people have to use enormous stretches of public land just to graze and make some kind of money off of it. And you know, I think we need to start having a discussion about whether that is in the public interest.
There are some examples, and you mentioned the Paseo Pantera in Central America. Conservation biologists ended up being set up against anthropologists and development people. The whole thing, which had a very good start, became a great bureaucratic tangle.
Yeah, some of these projects, and I think a lot of it depends on whether they're top-down. In other words, if they're being organized internationally or nationally on a government level, or whether they're being organized in part or in whole by grassroots initiatives. And I think you see this across the board, that it can be very dangerous for international organizations or government entities to come in and try to impose something on local people. And this may have been an element in the whole disaster in Catron County with the wolf, too. If there had been a way to really organize and educate the community before this happened, it might have been more effective. And that was certainly the case in Central America, that a lot of communities, a lot of villages and people, indigenous people, felt that something was being imposed on them that they didn't want. And there wasn't enough preparation and education and involvement of local people in the project. And it has become this kind of really incredible, disorganized and ineffectual program simply because there wasn't that groundwork.
What did the project Paseo Pantera set out to do?
Well,
the way of the panther, the path of the panther.
Right. They were hoping to reunite and create a kind of corridor effect up through Central America, which had been suffering from many conflicts and wars and guerrilla wars and so forth. And most of the forests had been lost in a lot of these countries. They had very extreme deforestation. And they were starting to see some really, damage from hurricanes and other events had caused a lot of erosion in these areas. So they were hoping to try and, use the national parks and reserves that were already there to create a kind of corridor that went up the whole isthmus to all the way to Mexico. And to some extent, that they have looked at some of these areas. They have, I think, improved some of the protected area management. But I don't think that they've really been able to add much on yet, although they are still working on this.
But it's an example of a lot of money spent, a lot of local people not gaining anything, saying, where the heck is that money going? And as you write, the tip-off that something like that is happening is that a lot of jargon gets thrown around, like stakeholders and capacity building. And when you hear those things, it's like a red flag.
Yeah, there's a lot of UN speak and bureaucratic nonsense that goes on with these planning, with the planning of these things at an international level. And I think people need to remember to speak English or whatever the language is where they are, to communicate effectively, because that's a huge problem, I think, particularly in the UN level.
We're talking to Caroline Fraser about her book, Rewilding the World. Now, let's hop over to Africa. That is a continent on which you have rhinoceroses, elephants, lions, which, as you point out, evolved with humans, and that's one of the reasons they're still coexisting.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing to look at the evolution of the ecosystems there. And I often have been so struck by the fact that so many people in African countries have an amazing attitude about the wildlife that they live with, that they are well, they have a healthy respect for dangerous species like lions and leopards. They don't have the urge to simply wipe them out, which is, I think, something that really afflicts the environmental movement here. And I wish that we could develop a little tolerance of the kind that they have there.
What is the ecological function of these large mammals? Let's say, for example, elephants and rhinos.
The landscape in Africa evolved with these enormous herbivores, elephants and rhinos, which are actually capable of keeping whole areas open. The Serengeti is believed to exist primarily because of elephants, that elephants move through there continually and are constantly keeping down the growth of trees. If you took elephants out of the Serengeti, you would probably have eventually a forest, a dry tropical forest. So they're critical parts of the landscape, and both elephants and rhinos also can eat the seeds of certain species, and then they poop them out and they become they are able to propagate those species in a way that no other animal can, because they have the tough jaws and the power in their incisors to actually crack open certain seeds.
So that's one of, again, many examples that you give of a species that is entirely dependent on another to survive and grow.
That's right, and the presence of these big herbivores is really critical both in the forest ecosystems of Africa and in the open savannas.
Now, elephants are an incredibly interesting study in so many ways. They live as long as we do. They're threatened. In some places, they're overabundant and they're being killed. What's going on?
Well, particularly in southern Africa, and I had not realized this before I went there, but they have a real history of erecting fences in that region for a number of different reasons. Some of them are border fences that were built during eras of conflict between South Africa and Mozambique, for instance. Some of them are veterinary fences, which are designed to keep the wildlife from interacting with livestock. They have quite a livestock industry in countries like Botswana that are critical to their economies. So they don't want to have hoof and mouth disease. They don't want the spread of these zoonotic diseases. So there are all these fences now which prevent the free movement of elephants and other big wildlife, and even some of the smaller antelope species, which has been really damaging to the wildlife in southern Africa. And so now they're developing some major projects that are designed to try and reduce some of that damage and make some openings in the fences.
And this leads to a huge question, which is the question of transboundary conservation, which you write about a lot in the book.
Yeah, these are major international projects that have been developed particularly to try to harmonize relations between neighboring countries, many of which have been at war with each other in the recent past. So Angola, for instance, with its neighbors, Zambia and Zimbabwe and Botswana and Namibia, is now working on a five-country mega transboundary peace park called CASA, which is designed to both improve the conservation of a whole region, which involves the Okavango Delta region, but also try to get these countries to cooperate in managing their natural resources. And the critical one, of course, with the Delta is fresh water.
Because of the fences that you were talking about, and because elephants have been abundant in some places, there have been these so-called culls, which are basically the killing of entire herds of elephants as a means of controlling their population. Elephants are responding with trauma responses to their killing and the killing of their families, the ones that survive, that are not unlike combat trauma human victims who survive wars.
Yeah, this is a kind of horrifying development, which they have studied in countries like South Africa, where they practiced culling for decades in their spectacular National Park Kruger. And I think that they are coming to a point. They've had a lot of conversations between communities and park officials and biologists, and I have the impression that they are coming to a point where they're trying to reduce the importance of culling in their management of elephants and trying to figure out ways to, instead of this very traumatizing activity of just shooting elephants from the air or darting them, to instead open up larger areas so that they can migrate and travel from place to place. But it's a really complex problem because there's only so much space, and even though Africa is an enormous continent, there are a lot of people living in rural areas who are affected by elephants destroying their crops and destroying their housing, and so it's a really delicate situation where they need to come up with ways to keep elephants and other dangerous wildlife from impacting on human communities too much.
It does also bring up some questions about, especially with species that are in a lot of ways so much like us, like elephants, strange as that may sound to some, the right of these species to live and have a decent life, not just for our benefit and the medicines we might derive from them and the health of the weather and the ecosystem and all of that, but just simply that they have a right to exist.
Yeah, and that is such an important point, particularly with species like elephants, because any time we come in contact with a species like elephants or dolphins or any species that seems to have some form of language, that seems to have an ability to communicate, that has a long lifespan, that has a very complex social structure, suddenly then we can see the moral quandary that we're creating by culling or poisoning on a large scale or really disrupting the social patterns and family behavior of these species. And it takes a species like elephants to really bring that home to us. I wish that we were able to see it across the board in a larger sense, but I think it's hard for people to relate to certain species like insects and snakes and lizards and crocodiles.
And microscopic organisms in the soil.
That's right.
We're talking to Caroline Fraser about her book, Rewilding the World, Dispatches from the Conservation Revolution. We have a very interesting example of Costa Rica, and that is a country that has basically taken on a commitment to doing rewilding on a large scale. And as we started out talking about, large scale is a very important part of the whole picture.
Yeah, Costa Rica has a fascinating history with this whole subject, because a long time ago, even in the 19th century, they were making the decision not to invest their resources in, for instance, a standing army, but instead to invest them in their protected areas, their national parks, and their people. As a result, they now have the highest level of literacy in Central America of around 90%. And they also have a population that is, many of them, trained in how to work in restoration, in bioliteracy, they call it, people who are trained to gather plants and animals from the rainforest, to identify them taxonomically, and possibly explore their relevance to the pharmaceutical industry or cosmetics.
Parataxonomists.
Parataxonomists are a whole class of people who have been trained in this kind of activity. And it's a really sort of fascinating job. I actually went out with a woman who works as a parataxonomist in one of the parks in Costa Rica, and went with her into the forest as she gathered certain kinds of leaves and plants to feed the caterpillars that they are growing back in their facility to have samples of different kinds of moth and butterfly species.
The creative ways of working that you're talking about, engaging people in a grassroots level, then they get a commitment to conservation and an understanding of conservation that many of us in the first world lack, many of us everywhere lack. I think it can't be overstated how crucial ecosystems are, intact ecosystems, functioning ecosystems on a large scale, and that it's not a choice that corporate America loves to set up between ecosystems and economics. It's really the contrary. They're utterly dependent on each other. How does that work?
Well, what I say in the book is that ecosystems, that the environment is the economy, and I think that we're just now coming to a realization of how much we take for granted in terms of the services that are provided by functioning intact ecosystems. And these can include everything from climate stability to fresh water to pollination is a huge service that we cannot replace on our own, that we get for free from the environment. And if we lose that service, we're losing billions of dollars. So I think we're just now coming to a realization of how much this is worth economically. But I think it's still hard for people to understand what an ecosystem is and how what it needs to function. And the analogy that I use in the book, which many people have used, is that, you know, I mean, we certainly understand that the cars that we drive and the airplanes that we fly in, that you can't just go into the engine and start taking out parts randomly and throwing them away.
Right.
Because you realize that that machine is not going to function. You know, I mean, you might get away with a screw here or a screw there, but are you going to want to fly in that plane after somebody's been taking parts out of the engine? Of course not. And I think that ecosystems are exactly the same in the sense that they are big organic machines, and we can't keep taking parts out of them and throwing them away.
And if we do, as we are doing, what are the worst dangers? What's happening? What is going to happen if we don't watch out?
Well, then you start to see degradation of these critical services. And they're seeing this in China, where they have used pesticides very heavily in certain areas, and that they have now lost the use, the freebie of pollinators. Their native pollinators have disappeared. And so they're now having to pollinate fruit trees, apple and pear trees, by hand. They have to arm whole, you know, thousands of people with these little sticks to which they have taped feathers, you know, chicken feathers and cigarette filters to go out and pollinate trees by hand.
Oh,
so that's the kind of thing. And we certainly see that here with our fresh water supplies. We're seeing critical degradation and diminishment of the amount, the quality and the quantity of fresh water.
Caroline Fraser is the author of the book Rewilding the World, Dispatches from the Conservation Revolution. It just came out in paperback. There's so much more to talk about, but we're just about out of time. How has this book been received in the year since it came out?
That's a great question. There have been, I think, a lot of fascination from people who are just not aware of these projects and how many of them there are, both in our, you know, local communities. I mean, even here in Santa Fe, there's a lot of stuff going on with restoration of the Santa Fe River, planting native vegetation along the river,
keeping prairie dogs,
and there, wherever you live, in whatever community you live, I think you're going to find that there's something going on that involves rewilding.
Caroline Fraser, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.